Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, a senior research scholar at Stanford University, and a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. I'm your chair and moderator for today. Today's program is being held in association with the Marines Memorial Association. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my great pleasure and honor to introduce our distinguished guest tonight, Admiral William Fallon, Commander of the United States Central Command. Admiral Fallon oversees the deployment of U.S. forces in Iraq, Afghanistan, Central Asia, and the Horn of Africa. His military biography is so dense it is hard to believe that it reflects just one life. Here are a few of the many highlights. William Fallon was raised in New Jersey and graduated in 1967 from Villanova University. That same year, he received his commission through the Navy ROTC program and became a naval aviator. He flew for the Navy for 24 years, starting with a combat deployment to Vietnam. He has logged nearly 5,000 hours in tactical jet aircraft and 1,300 carrier arrested landings. Whew! And he wishes he were still doing it, he just said. He commanded a carrier air wing aboard the Theodore Roosevelt in the Persian Gulf during Operation Desert Storm in 1991. He commanded the Theodore Roosevelt Battle Group and the Battle Force 6th Fleet during NATO's combat operations in Bosnia in 1995. He served as the Vice Chief of Naval Operations from 2000 to 2003. Then as commander of U.S. Fleet Forces and the U.S. Atlantic Fleet until 2005. Subsequently, he became commander of the U.S. Pacific Command from 2005 to 2007 with responsibility for countries such as China, India, and Russia. This year in March, he took command at the Central Command, the first naval officer ever to do so. And by the way, it is his fourth four-star level assignment. What his military bio doesn't really convey is his talent at being what is described as a soldier statesman. But in his case, I guess I should say a sailor statesman. Bill Fallon has broad diplomatic experience. He cultivated our bilateral alliance relationships in Asia at a time when they were strained. And as commander of PACOM, he made substantial contributions to the development of a more meaningful relationship with the Chinese military and security establishment. The range of countries and challenges for which he is now responsible are daunting, from Afghanistan to Iran, from Iraq to Sudan. So he will undoubtedly be drawing on all this experience and talent as he executes his new mission. Admiral Fallon was with the president yesterday in Iraq. And what is truly astonishing is that he is sitting here with us this evening. Please join me in welcoming him to San Francisco.
Well, Liz, thank you very much for that kind introduction. I'm happy that you went easy on me on the age thing. Dr. Duffy, Dr. Perry, Lee, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's a true pleasure to be back here in San Francisco. It's Tuesday, isn't it? And so I should tell you a little bit of a story here. I was leaving Iraq on Tuesday, but it was Tuesday a week ago. And the plan was to come back. I had a couple of stops in Jordan and Lebanon, and then to come to Washington, and then to join my wife and a couple of my children at our little hideaway in Montana. They'd actually given up on me some months ago and said, we're going to take a little vacation if you can join us. So the idea was I'd go there for a few days, pick up my wife, come here, because she's always anxious to come back, Lee, to see this beautiful area in the bay. And then we'd have a great time tonight. A little bit of a change in plan somewhere along in there. And as I recall now, Tuesday in Iraq, then Jordan to see King Abdullah and the leadership there, then into Beirut. First time there's been a senior military officer there in 23 years to meet with the leadership of that country. Then Washington, met with the president last Friday. I did go out Friday night, saw the family. Actually did a little bit of climbing and a little bit of fly fishing, and then flew back to Washington, flew to Iraq, left there Tuesday, I think whatever. No, maybe it was still Monday night, and came through Washington, and here we are. So I'm delighted. I got out of the plane here, went down, got a Buck Stars, and I'm pumped up and ready to go. How to cover so much territory in a short period of time. What I thought I would do is give you a little thumbnail sketch of what it is Central Command is tasked to do and tries to do, and then maybe a bit about Iraq and Afghanistan, since there are our principal areas of work, and a little bit more about the region, and then turn it over to you for your questions. And I gather there's quite a stack here, so that's probably about 4 hours worth, Liz.
This is just before you began to speak. Wait till you see what comes next.
Okay. I'm eager to take them on. Central Command. The U.S., many of you probably know, has divided the world up into areas of responsibility for our military commanders. There are five geographic regions, and the purpose is so that all of our men and women in uniform are covered by one of us with responsibility for them and their safety and lives somewhere in the world. But these tasks assume other responsibilities as well. Typically for our operations and engagements with our other interagency partners and our international partners in the world in these regions. So the Central Command goes from northeastern Africa, Sudan, Egypt, and Ethiopia, Somalia, so forth, up through the Gulf area, Middle East, and up into Central Asia. And anything that ends with a stan is my responsibility, or at least the people that work there are my responsibility. So what do we do? Execute government policies. We work closely with our Department of State and the other agencies of the U.S. government and our coalition partners and allies, really to do something that's very fundamental, and that is to provide security and stability to the best of our ability in this region. And that, I've discovered, is a significant challenge in the CENTCOM area. Now, I used to think that the Pacific Command was a challenge, certainly from a time-distance standpoint. But when I got to Central Command, I realized that there's an awful lot of work to do because many of the countries there are challenged in ways that are daunting, and particularly when one looks around at the benefits that we enjoy in terms of governance and fundamental infrastructure and things that we often, I suspect, take for granted that just don't exist in these other lands. It leaves us with lots to do, many, many opportunities, as I am fond to tell my staff. And so it's busy. You know as well as I that we've been engaged in combat operations in Iraq for a number of years now. This is a very, very complex situation. It's changed significantly from 2003, and whatever has gone on in the past is good for us to note and to draw lessons from, but today is today. And I'm focused on figuring out what we do today and tomorrow as a priority task. We have some 160,000 U.S. citizens that are under arms in Iraq today. They are doing absolutely phenomenal work. Just had another chance yesterday to see for myself what they do and how they do it. And it just fills me with pride beyond belief to see what they do, how they do it, and how willing they are to do whatever is asked of them. It's really a tribute to this country who, among all in the world, has been willing to do things for people in other places that are often very difficult, that are shied away from by many as too challenging, too tough. And yet we have young people, many of them in their early 20s, who shoulder these responsibilities and do it in a manner and style that would bring tears to your eyes, as it does to mine, I'll tell you, when I see them. Nonetheless, they have some significant challenges in Iraq. It's a mixed bag, but I'll tell you that in the less than 6 months that I've been in this job, I have seen a substantial change, and it gives me some significant optimism that this place may just work out the way we had envisioned, or some had envisioned some years ago when the tasks were undertaken. Why would I say that? Because there is significant change on the ground. I got to tell you that it is very complex. There are things that go on that are obvious. There are many things that occur that are not easily discernible, certainly to our eyes, because it's a different land with a different culture and a different people. But I would tell you that there's a fundamental belief that I have, that I've observed and cultivated through these 40 years I've been serving in uniform, and that is that the vast majority of people around this world, no matter what they look like, where they come from, what they believe, share a very, very common desire to live in peace. And that fundamental desire, I think, is a significant motivator and will continue to help us as the situation in Iraq unfolds. So where to begin? The topic du jour is the surge and security. What's going on now in the security business in Iraq is that things are substantially improved. By almost any measure, any statistical analysis of what's happened here in the last several months, there's been an improvement. How does this translate? What's it mean? Now, what it means is that people can go about their lives in a manner that they couldn't do just a few months ago. It means that our people, our men and women that are serving over there, are suffering substantially less casualties than they were just a few months ago. Are things perfect? Far from it. Are there things, immense challenges left to go? Certainly are. But our people, in concert with their coalition allies, and increasingly by the growing capacity of the Iraqi security forces, are making a huge difference day to day. I'll give you a couple of examples. The area of Iraq that I thought was probably the most challenging for the last 3 years has been the western part of the country, Anbar province. It covers about a third of the country. This has been a challenge because it's almost exclusively Sunni, and that's a factor here because the majority of the conflict today involves grinding between Sunni and Shia sectarian interests. Anbar was and still is almost all Sunni. That is very helpful in many ways, but it was a real problem a couple of years ago and up until very recently, because this is the Sunni heartland. It's only 20% of the population, but this is the background from which Saddam came, and his most staunch, stalwart supporters were from this area. They took to the attacks by the coalition, by our presence there, in a very negative way. They joined with al-Qaeda to inflict tremendous punishment on our people, and we found ourselves in a very, very difficult fight. This has changed, I believe, for a number of reasons. First of all, fundamentally, back to this issue of peace, people are tired of it. They've just gotten fed up. I had a chance last evening at the end of the meetings to quietly talk with some of the Iraqi leaders, the sheikhs, the tribal leaders, the traditional leaders in this society. And I asked them why they were doing this. And this is renouncing al-Qaeda, coming over from fighting us to working with our coalition forces and trying to provide some security for their own people. I met one interesting man. He's lost his wife, 3 sons, and a brother to al-Qaeda. Why? Because he had come over and asked his tribe to come over and help our coalition forces. It's a pretty high price to pay. It would seem to me that he might be a candidate to say somebody else ought to do this. But he said, no, I'm going to stay with it. And this kind of example, I think, is one of the reasons that this place may come out the way we really would like it to be, and that is a country that has some representational government for its people who can live in a reasonable degree of peace and stability and get on with their lives. It's going to take an awful lot of courageous people. But back to Anbar. Anbar is mostly worked by our United States Marine Corps. They've been hard at it, and they've suffered a lot of casualties in the past. I was over there at the end of last year to visit some of my – I was in a different job then in the Pacific, but I had a lot of my troops that were deployed to the area, and I wanted to see how they were doing. And they were doing they were in a tough situation. To go back now, 7-8 months later, and see the difference is pretty remarkable. They changed their tactics. They consulted with some of the people that live there. They took a hard look at what they needed to do, and they changed. We also put a substantially increased number of forces out there because they just couldn't handle the territory. It was too big. But during this time, the local people were getting fed up with just constant bloodshed and turmoil, and they began to ask for help. But they were intimidated. This is a really tough crowd. How do they do with it? How do they do it? They reverted to something in their culture that is that's very significant and holds a very strong place in their daily lives, and that's tribal background. The tribal sheikhs rose to the fore. Saddam tried to get rid of them, tried to minimize them because they were represented a challenge to him. A lot of these folks had fled. The leaders had gone to Jordan or to Syria or some other place. Some of those who were left went back, asked their cohorts in the other countries to come back and join them, and they began to work together to try to take back the territory. And it's been remarkable what's happened. 8 straight months now, the violence level in Anbar, which was the most challenging part of the entire country, has now come down. And it's remarkable to see. I was in the city of Fallujah a couple of weeks ago, probably one of the principal battlegrounds of the entire country of Iraq. Remarkable difference. It looks awful, I'll tell you, right up front. It's devastated. But what I saw were hundreds of thousands of people that were coming around, trying to get out, and little things that I take note of. One, fewer and fewer Marines guarding the streets. Most of the people that were doing local security were local citizens who had sworn allegiance to the government and to our forces to try to help. And they were the most visible presence. The other thing, I noticed that about half of the houses in the city had a pile of fresh cinder blocks in front of them. What's this all about? A lot of the houses are damaged. What this is indicative of is people deciding on their own, individually, to stay in this city, to rebuild it, and to get on with their lives. So little things like this, I think, are pretty remarkable. I could give you lots and lots of examples. I think I'll save it for the questions. There's an awful lot of work to do. The biggest challenge in my mind is to figure out how to connect what's obviously a very dynamic and growing grassroots movement at the local level to change things with the government at the highest level to try to get these things too connected so the government can, so the people can get on with their lives. It's a challenge at the high levels because the culture is very different, because they've had 35 years of rule by Saddam and his henchmen, intimidating people into silence and fear. And so to suddenly change that, to suddenly feel that they're comfortable in standing up and saying, let's do something different, is really very, very challenging. They're doing it slowly but surely. But there has to be an awful lot of effort here on the parts of lots of people to make this happen. The business of silence and fear has to be overcome. How? I think by example. By the example of the sheikh who was willing to acknowledge the sacrifices in his own family, but stand up because he knows there's a higher need. By the leaders who have been picked by their various elements and parties within the country to get together and to make those difficult decisions to cooperate with one another. Because it's about trust. That's the fundamental issue. Can they work together? Can they believe in one another to be able to share the obvious largesse of this country, and they've got lots of oil and lots of revenue coming in, And people say to me, well, you know, that's interesting, Admiral. We see all these things. We'll acknowledge the security is improving. We acknowledge that there are a lot of grassroots things. But what about the top? This government's dysfunctional. It can't seem to get anything done. In many respects, that's true. But I'd ask you to keep in mind a few other things that I can see. There is revenue coming in from these oil sales. Somehow, that revenue is getting out to the people because they, in these provinces, are now receiving substantial amounts of money and able to turn around and let people use it. Saddam inflicted a culture of dependency on this country. Remarkable. I didn't realize the extent. People were totally dependent on the central government, his government, for everything, including food. It's amazing to me in a country this rich in agricultural land that they are totally dependent on central food distribution, but they are. But that's going on behind the scenes, but it happens, even in the most difficult, challenged areas of the country. So I think that while this grassroots effort is gathering momentum, that there's still an awful lot already underway at the top. Somehow these things are going to get connected. They need a little more time. They need the stability and security that they're getting, and that's the objective of our efforts there today. Another thought is that the prime drivers of violence today in this country are Al-Qaeda on the one hand, Sunni-supported historically, that's changing. On the other hand, the Shia extremists, typically they're known as JAM, the Jaish al-Mahdi. This is a sectarian group, violently inclined, gets lethal support from Iran, and they're squeezing both sides in the middle of the people. Increasingly, I think the pressures from these sides are putting the people in the middle together, and I think that's the way ahead here. A lot of change underway. But let me move on to another place that occupies a fair amount of my time, and that's Afghanistan. Different situation, further down the road from us. This is a place in which I have high hopes for a number of reasons. It's rugged. It's tough. It's a people that have been independent and resisted outside intervention by anybody for a long time. But this is a population that virtually every place I go welcomes our forces, welcomes the coalition forces, the NATO allies that are helping. They support their government. They support their leaders. And they're trying to make a better life for themselves. In fact, I have a challenge in that they are so anxious to do things for themselves that I'm just make sure you got this before you run, folks, because we want to make sure that this comes out right. They have a dynamic leader in President Karzai. They have a security force that is well-led, and they are being trained by a number of coalition partners in addition to the U.S., and they're making great strides. The country is difficult in many ways. It is challenged by literacy rates that are in the neighborhood of about 30%. There is difficulty getting word and communications around. But fundamentally, these are people who want to be independent, who want to be in charge of their own security, and want to be having better lives. And there's an awful lot that's moving forward in that direction. I've got a lot of other pieces of turf. I don't want to take you on a travelogue through every one of these countries. I will tell you that a couple of areas are of high interest to me. One is Northeast Africa, which has been troubled for a number of reasons. Darfur in the news. Somalia has been in the news for a number of years. But I see changes there as well. Ethiopia has been a country that has been helpful. They've been trying to help the neighborhood as well as their own people. And we're trying to work with them to enable them to be more helpful and productive to the region. Central Asia, I find a fascinating area. I'd worked with these folks about 10 years ago in a different job. I see a tremendous amount of opportunity there and things that could be extremely helpful in the entire region. For example, in the days of the Soviet Empire, most of these countries, of course, were part of the Soviet Union. In the last 15, 16 years, as these borders have changed and these countries have become independent, they've had difficulty in reaching out in different directions because the way this was designed in the Soviet days was that all the communication lines led back into Moscow. And so I believe that they have a future in different directions, and they're trying to realize this as well. For example, there is an imbalance of resources. Some countries are very well off in oil and gas, others well off in water, timber, so forth. Most of the economies are underdeveloped, and most suffer from significant shortfalls in transportation, communications. Trying to get them to think north-south, out of the steppes of Central Asia, through Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. There are phenomenal market possibilities down to the south and east. They've never really looked in this direction before. I think there's a phenomenal potential to increase their lives, to make their lives better, and to share some of this this wealth in this part of the world. Probably don't have enough hours in a day to address all the things I'd like to in this region, but there are lots of possibilities. And these independent countries are, in fact, looking around, trying to make sure that they have the ability to maneuver and make decisions on their own, and the degree to which we can support them, first of all, by education, by making information available, is really one of the high priorities I have. So I think that's probably enough to start maybe through this pile of questions. So I'll end it there and turn it over to Liz to have at it.
Please Thanks. Join me in thanking Admiral William Fallon, commander of the U.S. Central Command. For those of you in our radio audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and our guest is Admiral William Fallon, commander of the U.S. Central Command. We're going to talk about the audience questions now. I'm going to try to organize this in some way that allows us to stay on one topic before we move to another. There are tremendous questions from this audience tonight. They're deeply serious and substantive questions. We're going to range across and around your region and see if we can touch upon them all. And if you don't hear your words asked, I will hope to paraphrase them in a way that will capture the general thrust of the questions that have come up on a number of topics. Obviously, the greatest concern in this room is about where we are in Iraq, and there is deep skepticism in the audience about whether the surge is working. So the question to you is, what is the evidence that the surge is working, and if it is not working, how long will we need to stay in Iraq, and what does the military need to do to prepare for that?
The surge, as it's popularly known, is a bit misleading. There is certainly a surge in forces, about 30,000 U.S. troops and some support folks that went in beginning early this year, and all of them are finally in place in June. But there's a lot more that's gone on in addition to an increase in people, a fundamental shift in what our people were doing and what they have been doing. From basically in the prior year, trying to hand off responsibility for most things having to do with security to the Iraqi forces. Our people, quite frankly, have been, in the past few months, imposing security on this country. We've been leading it. We have a lot of partners from our coalition allies, and more importantly, day by day, by the Iraqis themselves. But frankly, they were not up to the task. And our forces have had to step in and do it, and they've been doing that with great zeal and vigor. There have been tremendous changes, and I guess it's difficult to describe how quickly this thing has changed and how fundamentally the various currents within this country are moving and changing almost weekly. Things that I am there regularly, would see and then go back a couple of weeks later and see different. Many of these things are absolutely unanticipated. Many of these things would not be possible were it not for the fact that a lot of the bullets have stopped flying, a lot of the explosions have stopped, and people actually have a chance to breathe and to think and do things together. And so how long it will take, there's been a significant increase in good things in the past several months. I think as I look to the future, long term, I would look to have a long term security relationship with this country of Iraq. The idea that we're either in or we're out is a zero sum game, I think, is not anywhere near the realm of what we ought to be thinking about. We have very significant long-term interests in this region. We would like to have relationships with every country, good relationships with every country. That's not possible with all, but we sure work had our heart at it. And in this country of Iraq, in a critical location, next to Iran, really historically, if you go back and look at it, it's been a country that's been in the mainstream of the Middle East for hundreds and hundreds of years. So we'd like to have a security relationship, not one in which we impose security. They take care of security for their country. We have a presence. That presence could involve training. It could involve equipping. It could involve relationships that we have with almost every other country in the region to varying degrees. So the ability to transition from where we are today to be able to bring our troop levels down is going to be dependent in some respects on the ability of the Iraqis to step up. The numbers of their folks that are going through training and being deployed in the field are substantially increased this year from last. We have a plan to continue to do that. And so the president, as you know, is receiving advice. I've had the opportunity to see him. I've given him what I think. I know that some of my colleagues have. General Petraeus, whom we saw yesterday, is on his way back to Washington today. He's going to get a chance to give him a detailed brief, as have all the other leaders over the next week or so. And then you're going to hear from Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus. I'll tell you one thing. We're very fortunate in this country that we have so many good people that are working the problem. As I look at the complexities inside of Iraq today, with these constantly shifting currents, with things that are happening and responses to other things that are occurring, we're really, really blessed to have the A-team on the scene. Ambassador Crocker, extensive experience in countries all over the Middle East, steady, unflappable, the picture of a diplomat. My hat goes off to him. General Petraeus and his team working their heart out. So we've got good people on the ground. I think this is going to take a while. This is not going to be today we're gone, but I think you're going to see some smart decisions coming up in the very near future, and it's going to put us on a way that we're going to be that will give us the best chance of achieving the objectives we'd like to have, which is a stable country in this region, and to be able to then get our troops back out of there and have the Iraqis have responsibility.
There are many questions about the role of contractors in Iraq. We understand that there are about 180,000. A substantial portion of those are Iraqis, but still this is a large force. Mm-hmm. We're interested in knowing how this works. Is it a problem for command and control?
Okay.
What should be done going forward to address this issue?
Contractors. Having spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C., and some of you have as well, the mention of the word contractors has some ominous negative reaction to some by some folks. The truth is that in Iraq, contractors are there in large measure doing things that if they didn't do them, we would have to have our men and women in uniform doing. And so the idea is to have our folks focus on those things they are really trained to do, and that is to provide the actual security, and to have these other folks do these things that are not necessarily the realm of our men and women in uniform. That said, there are many people doing any number of things. There are billions and billions of dollars that have been and continue to be spent by our country and other countries to try to improve the infrastructure in this country, to try to fix the many, many things, I'm still looking for things that aren't broken. These are experts from around the world. They're engineers. They're contractors of the infrastructure repair type. They are people that are providing food service for others that are working there, for our own troops, so that we don't have to deploy people to do all these things, that they can be done by others. Increasingly, and the objective of most of this is to get most of this work being done by the Iraqis themselves, so they benefit from it. The wages that they earn end up being able to be spent in that economy. So we have people doing all manner of things, and my sense is that more and more of these tasks that are being performed are going to be turned over to Iraqis.
And from a command perspective, this doesn't present a challenge?
No, there are some There are, I think, some of the focus of the debate in Washington has been the security contractors, because many entities, including our own Department of State, have hired people to protect them, again, so that our military people can be out doing things in the field. And there are rules by which these security people operate. They are required to submit to an outline of things, requirements ahead of time, and they're held accountable for their actions. But the vast majority of the contractors in the country are doing things that many would consider mundane, but they're absolutely essential to the day-to-day existence of our troops and the people of this country.
One last question on Iraq, though we could take up the entire evening discussing it. Many members of the audience want to know about the morale of our troops.
The morale is incredible. I am just in awe of these people. We have soldiers who have been to Iraq or Afghanistan several times. We have, I would say, I don't have the statistics, I'm sure the services keep these, but the average mid-grade officer or non-commissioned officer that I encounter in both countries has been there two or three times. There are some of our people that are particularly high skill and high demand areas, our special forces people, our Army Green Berets and Navy SEALs, some of our Marines who have been there six and seven times for periods, not the year or 15 months that some of the soldiers are now, but for shorter periods. But the good news is that they're exceedingly experienced. They're very wizened. And they're very helpful to our young troops with their experience. The bad news, the downside of this, of course, is that they're spending an awful lot of time away from families. But their morale is extraordinary. Last night I got to witness a group of men and women, probably maybe 2,000 or so, I don't know how many. They filled a huge hall, and they were eagerly waiting for several hours for the group that was visiting President, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and senior military officers, the chairman, to get a glimpse of these people and maybe get a couple words. And the audience was, as I scanned it, young, in their 20s, men and women, all services. And my ears hurt from the roar, deafening roar of their cheers as they were asked by the president, how's their morale? So there's no doubt about it. It's tough, I'm going to tell you, in many places. This time of year, the reality on the ground in Iraq is that it's dry and it's hot. It's in the 120, 130 range. That's Fahrenheit. The dirt is bone dry, and the soldiers were kidding me that I was going to take a walk on the moon last week when I was with them. And I was kind of puzzled, what is this they're talking about? And then I understood. And I get out of the helicopter in a huge cloud of dirt, and the terrain is covered with 3 to 8 inches, I'd say, of this fluffy dust that if you step on it with your boot, it kind of, if you've ever walked in a dry snow, kind of powdery snow flies, except it's dirt. That covers the entire landscape. And so whenever the soldiers move, of course, this stuff floats around in the air, and it's really a challenge. But they endure it, and their spirits are high. Our people believe they're making a difference. I think this is the really fundamental thing. They're the people that actually get to see things in Iraq. They endure the pain. They endure the sweat. They endure the casualties. But they see the Iraqi people. And our people believe that what they're doing is the right thing to do. They know it's hard. They know that people doubt about the background. They have doubts about how long this ought to go on or how long it's gone on or why it started and so forth. But when they see the people that they actually get a chance to help, they believe in it. And that's why their morale is high. And they believe in one another. Thanks.
That is very moving. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Admiral William Fallon, commander of the U.S. Central Command, which oversees U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. He is discussing the challenges to stability and security in those regions. Admiral Fallon, we have a dozen questions about Iran. There is great concern about how likely it is that the United States will attack Iran, and if so, what it would achieve. Can you talk to us about this part of your area of responsibility?
Sure. Iran is a key nation in the Middle East. It's very capable. It has an educated population. Historically, achievements that go back for centuries, and I believe should be playing a very constructive role in the region. Regrettably, it has not. At least since I've been on the job, I have seen at almost every turn the public decisions that have been made by the Iranian government have been unhelpful, not just to the United States, but to the region. Virtually every opportunity, first of all with the UN and the drive to try to get them to come clean on their nuclear program has been blown away and snubbed, defying the opinions of countries around the world. They are playing a particularly destructive and harmful role in Iraq, where the unique lethality of a thing called the EFP, explosively formed projectiles, these are very, very deadly devices that can penetrate the armor on our vehicles and are particularly harmful to our people. There is no doubt that these are being provided to the insurgent zealots in Iraq by Iran. In Afghanistan, we see evidence of more things being provided to insurgents there, which is really interesting, and why another reason why this region is so challenging. In Afghanistan, the insurgents, those opposed to the government, are the Taliban and al-Qaeda supporting them out of their safe havens in Pakistan and eastern Afghanistan. Ideologically, they're on the other side of the spectrum from the Iranian Shia, and yet they find common ground in nefarious deeds. We find Iran playing a particularly negative role in Lebanon. I just went back to Lebanon for the first time in 24 years. I was very, very happy to visit this country, to meet with the Prime Minister, Siniora, and Defense Minister Moore. I have a soft spot in my heart for Lebanon, probably because when I was a youngster, I got a chance to visit this place in the 1960s when it was the pearl of the Middle East. And then I was unfortunately there in the 80s when it was in turmoil and civil war. So I'm anxious to see this place in another revival to resume its position as a leader in the region. It's being held back by an insurgency in the south that's funded and equipped by the Iranians. In the Levant, in the West Bank, in Gaza, there is a very negative role being played by Iran in these areas. So I'm a little bit puzzled by a country that seems to go out of its way to cause trouble and to instigate and infuriate its neighbors. As I make the rounds of the countries in the region, without exception, every one of the countries in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, Jordan, Egypt, they are all very nervous about Iran, and they constantly ask me to do what I can to help. Now, it's a bit of a dilemma here because I get it both ways. Admiral, you've got to understand how serious this is. This is a problem, so we need help, but please don't attack. I said, we're okay. I don't plan to attack the place. That's not my charter. We have plenty of work to do. What we'd like to do is have Iran realize that it needs to be playing a constructive role in this region. It's critically important. Everybody's watching them. I think it's high time that government decided to start looking around and working to further the interests of the region for peace and stability rather than just looking at itself. And so no plans to attack Iran. Every plan to try to work with the other countries in the region to get them to be playing a constructive role.
We also have concerns in the audience about Pakistan. Mm-hmm. You do have quite a theater of responsibility.
Pakistan is any specific question?
There are many, but we've put our bets on Musharraf. Can he keep it together? What if he doesn't? What are the implications for our relationship with India, which you used to have responsibility for?
Well, I guess I should start by saying that having been the Pacific commander with men We always have lines, but as a sailor, I have yet to see a line on the ocean, so I tend to ignore these boundaries. And so when I was in the Pacific Command with responsibility for India and countries north and east, I also tried to put my finger across the border and to pull Pakistan in, and invited Pakistan's senior military people to join the Pacific region people, including India, whenever we had a conference, so that they would feel that they were welcome. And so, switching roles, I was greeted by the tom-toms passing the word that you better watch out for this guy Fallon, because, of course, he loves India and he's going to have a real negative view of Pakistan, which is nonsense. But it's actually, I should tell you a little anecdote. About this time last year, I was in on a visit to India, and my wife was with me, and we were invited by the Indians to go to Kashmir and to visit the line of control that separates Pakistan and Indian forces up there. And I don't think anybody, senior military type, had been there any time recently, so I was eager to go. And so we went and we walked along the border, we saw the security fences, we talked to the commanders. I was heartened by the fact that the level of violence in Kashmir was steadily coming down. I was encouraged by the fact that the governments of India and Pakistan were talking to one another and there were measures being taken to detention this area, which is critically important because both have nuclear weapons and, as you know, have been at blows with each other in the last several decades. So the visit, I thought, was good for me. I hope the Indians got something from it. And I went on about my business. A few weeks later, one of my staffers came to me and said, "Admiral, you ought to read this. This is an article that appeared in a Pakistani newspaper." And I opened this thing up and read it and was rather astounded to read that the commentator took note of my visit to Indian-occupied Kashmir, in his words, and speculated as to the rationale for this, and said that it was done in great secrecy, which I don't quite recall, but at any rate, if it made the story better, so what? And said that it was the express invitation of the Indian leadership, and that I was there probably, they speculated, to advise the Indians on ways in which they might reduce their forces on the border. And they have about 1 million-man army guarding that frontier, which I think is a great idea. It further speculated that soon Pakistan might have a visit from a senior-ranking United States military officer, maybe the commander of Central Command, who would then offer the same advice to the PACs. And I thought that was amazing. Now, this is before this whole business of Central Command even came about. But I think I like the story a whole lot, and I like the direction. And what I liked most was that someone in Pakistan would actually think along those lines in a positive sense, recognizing the value of having these forces come down. Pakistan is very complex, and there's political turmoil going on today. I've met President Musharraf a number of times. He's been very helpful. There's been an awful lot of flack back and forth in print and in word about the degree to which Pakistan has or has not been helping us. Since I've been on the job, Pakistan has been very, very helpful. They have an immense task. It's a country that has lots of challenges in every form and shape. It's been troubled in the past. It has this strategic issue with India and nuclear weapons and the future. It has an insurgency in the West. It has a territory known as the Fatah, the federally administered tribal areas that have historically been ungoverned, at least by the central government. And it's a legacy of the British rule from a couple of centuries ago. Brits recognized this is a real problem as well, and their solution for it was up in the high mountains to keep the regular army out of there and to have the locals take care of business. And the locals took care of business in their way. One has to remember that this is tribal, first and foremost. And the border, the defined border, the Durand Line, the generally accepted but not by all demarcation between these two countries, is one that's virtually not recognized by the tribal entities, particularly the Pashtuns, who occupy historically land in both Pakistan and India, Pakistan and Afghanistan, and they tend to go back and forth all the time, and they like it, so they like no border. The PACs, on the other hand, are anxious to have a border because they see trouble coming over. And we in the U.S. have had a real problem because Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden and his gang, to the best of our knowledge, have and continue to still occupy someplace in this region along the PAC-Afghan border, which is some of the most formidable terrain in the world, very, very high, rugged mountains, few roads. It's difficult. You have to slog it out on foot for weeks to get in and out of this place. Very inaccessible, historically ungoverned, guarded by local tribes who have affinities to one another in ways that we can't quite fathom. And the PAC government has been loath to get in there. They know that getting into this area in the West will take their eyes off of what they perceive to be their strategic challenge, which is in the East. And so there's great reluctance within the governing institutions to get too tied up in this. But they have taken steps in the past 3 or 4 months. President Musharraf has told me personally that he's committed to trying to help the situation, and that is to try to rout out these insurgents who are causing pain not only to him, as you saw in the Red Mosque incident, but certainly inside of Afghanistan. And so he has taken steps, courageous steps, to help us. He's got some problems, some that he may have brought on himself, but there's a lot of politics there that is not really my realm. Pakistan is a critical country. It's one that we would like to have close to us. Because of the history with India, it's very important that they not feel isolated and alone. They are critical allies in this war on global terrorism because of the hideouts for the leaders that are up in those mountain areas. And it's a country that needs a lot of help. And we, among others in the world, are one of the few that can really give that to them. We have a new ambassador. Her name is Ann Patterson. She's a terrific lady. She's filled with experience and zeal, and she's been working hard to come up with programs that will be helpful to the PACs as well as ourselves. So I got my fingers crossed. It's another significant challenge for all those that are involved in it, but one in which we're very hopeful that they'll sort out their political ways and figure out a way ahead.
Thank you. The Bay Area has a large Indian-American community, so I'm going to stay in this sub-region in South Asia, and then we'll go west to Afghanistan and we'll go north to Central Asia. On India, it's a potential new ally. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine a scenario in which India becomes a partner with whom we would plan and train and equip like we do with our NATO forces?
Sure. This is a terrific development in my mind. For decades, as a U.S. military officer, we tended to look at India as kind of on the other side. They were non-aligned officially, but we had very little to do with them and tended to view them as on the other side of the Cold War from us because they got most of their training equipment and so forth from the Soviet Union. Several years ago, although I believe that things were thawing, the freeze between us was thawing, several years ago, I began to see significant interest on the part of the Indian military leadership to want to get closer to us, which I thought was very welcome news indeed. Another little anecdote. In the small things of this world, little events and relationships sometimes loom large. I have a good friend of mine who was a classmate in school back as an undergraduate. He also came in the Navy as a NROTC graduate and served for a number of years. Walt Doran's his name. He just retired as a Pacific Fleet commander a couple of years ago. Walt had an interesting experience as a young officer. He went to India. And he studied at the Indian War College, a rare opportunity for him. During the Cold War years, a few of the Indian leaders had a chance to come to the U.S. and study at our schools. These experiences became very large in recent years as these connections were reestablished. And people said, hey, here's a guy who's actually experienced this in the U.S. and a guy who's experienced that in India. And we can find an awful lot of common ground. So there's been a remarkable turnaround and thawing of that relationship. I think it's in our extreme best interest to have a better relationship with India. I'm very pleased with the developments along this line. India is a huge country. It's over 1 billion people. and it's a democracy. It's rough and tumble. It's not quite like ours. There are a lot of challenges, as you might imagine, in a society that large, with that many people and the history. But there are a lot of reasons to think that this is has potential for good. I'm anxious to continue to exploit it. And the opportunity to have a good relationship with India, which we didn't particularly have for many years, to match up with a better relationship that we have had historically with Pakistan and put these together, I think, is good news for us in the long term.
Moving to Afghanistan, the biggest concern expressed here is that we have deprived that effort of what it needed to succeed because of our preoccupation with Iraq. And you reported good news. We know that the effort has transitioned to a NATO command now, though substantial U.S. forces remain. Give us a snapshot of whether you believe we're going to have to be there for the long term as well to make up for some of what happened early on.
A couple of things that are going on in the background. The number of forces is substantially smaller. This is a very, very rugged country, extremely difficult to move around in. The most significant factors that I see are a population that very much welcomes the presence of coalition forces. Yes, there are some problems. Yes, there are issues. There always are. There are 30 million people live in this country, by the way. But by and large, you can go to almost any city or town and feel very welcomed by the population. Why? They've experienced the bad news of the Taliban, and they don't like it, didn't like it, and they really don't want it back again. Taliban is another issue. I think that this the idea that we have a easily distinguished monolithic thing that we can color and paint and say that's Taliban, I think, is a little bit off the mark. There are insurgents. There are people who fight against one another. There are people who fight the government. There are people who fight us for a host of different reasons. But the key points in Afghanistan are the population is very much behind those who are there to help them and to give them a better future. Their leaders are struggling with underdevelopment, illiteracy, endemic corruption. The list goes on and on. It's as long as both arms. But they are generally an optimistic people who are looking for a brighter future. Their military leaders, the Army, Minister of Defense, senior leaders get it. They know what they need to do. They're eager to do it. They want to take responsibility. They'd love to take over tomorrow and invite us to just come and visit and do exercises. They know they're not quite ready, but they're anxious to pick it up. And that, those are very, very positive trends. There are challenges in the country. I'll tell you that when I got into this job earlier this year, I got my briefings, the intelligence briefings. I read the history of what had gone on the last 3 or 4 years. Frankly, what happened in Afghanistan is that after 2001, 2002, we saw great success. Thank you very much. We had this other problem in Iraq in 2003, and so most of the attention and, most importantly, most of the resources went there. That was turned around last year as significant resources, particularly for development, came back, began to flow back into Afghanistan. There were dire predictions when I got into this job about how security was going to deteriorate radically, and the level of incidents projected to climb on this huge mountain of bad news. That has not been the case. Despite the dire predictions of this spring, the level of violence, the number of incidents, has not increased anywhere near the pace it was. In fact, I'm anxious to see the actual tallies from August, but the actual lines of incidents has cut off this projected hump. And actually running a little bit less than last year. We are not out of the woods. There's a lot of work to be done. And there are some negative influences, particularly in the business of suicide bombers, which have migrated now into Afghanistan. Folks around the world that perpetrate this kind of violence have a network where they exchange information. It didn't originate in the Middle East. It originated, of course, in Sri Lanka more than three decades ago, but bad actors of the world recognize if you can intimidate people, if you can put fear in them, make them feel uneasy, then other things are possible. But the trends in Afghanistan in many respects are positive. They need a lot of help economically, and what I would like to do is figure out how we can organize better or really not mine, but our ambassador. We have a new ambassador there, Bill Wood. He's a phenomenal guy, very experienced. You have dozens and dozens of countries from around the world that are there to help. That's the good news. The challenge is, how do you get this all funneled so that we're supportive and complementary of one another instead of everybody trying to do their own thing? And President Karzai wants to be in charge of his country, recognizes the challenges, recognizes that he has to have a relationship with Pakistan that's very positive if they're going to have success, but they're hard at it. And it's a place that I enjoy going to visit. The enthusiasm is contagious. Thanks.
I'm going to ask you one follow-up question on Afghanistan. It pertains to other areas in which you are working as well. Does the U.S. government, outside the military, have the capacity to support what the military is doing? This is a strand that has run through many of the questions tonight.
It would be terrific if we could surge 30,000 people from other agencies. The fact is that our U.S. agencies aren't designed to be surged overseas. They're designed to work in small numbers in distant places. So the idea that we're suddenly going to find 30,000 people with the competencies and experiences that are really helpful in this area is probably unrealistic. And so as I see security being expanded into areas in Iraq and Afghanistan, there is still a significant need for people to fill in to be able to work these development issues to enable the infrastructure in these countries and, more importantly, the competencies in things like law and order and just governance to fill in behind us. Because what I see in Iraq particularly right now, it's a really delicate time. As general security has increased, as the level of violence has stabilized, people are looking around for other things. Another anecdote, a week ago Sunday, I was up in a place called Bakuba in Diyala province. Diyala has been the most challenging area outside of Baghdad for this past year. Why? Because Diyala is a split population of Sunni and Shia, and the militants on both sides have been vying for control of this. So the extremists on both ends pressurize it. Of course, the poor folks in the middle are the men and women that get chewed up. Anyway, Diyala's been a problem. I was in the city of Bakuba 3 months ago visiting our troops. It was not pretty. While I was visiting with the mayor and the police chief downtown, mortar shells are raining down. You could hear bullets flying. I was there on Sunday. Not a single shot, not a single round. The place doesn't look very good because it's been a battleground, a tough one for 3 months. But what I found remarkable is the people. As I mingle with folks on the street, I didn't get a single comment about security, which I thought was very interesting. But I had lots of comments about food, about electricity, about water, about gas, and most importantly, about jobs. You know, what can I do? We need a job. I need an income. We've gotten some food, but we need more. And when can we drive our cars in here? When can we get more things into the market? I want to open my shop, Mr. What can I do, Mr. General? You know, and inshallah, this will come to pass. But that's significant, folks. This is, but there, to go back to the question, there's a significant need for other people to fill in and do these nation-building tasks.
The former Soviet Central Asian states, the stands as you described them, in the mid-1990s under Bill Perry's leadership, we developed strong defense and military ties with those countries, and to many Americans' surprise, they stood with us after 9/11, and we used their bases for the deployment to Afghanistan. Some of those relationships have soured, most notably with Uzbekistan. We no longer have basing rights there. What is your assessment of the prospect for improvement, and what can you do with your leadership at CENTCOM to bring that about?
First, a disclaimer. I have not been to Uzbekistan yet. It's the only country I have not not been able to into, and I, given the other priorities, I haven't pushed real hard, but they haven't exactly welcomed me with open arms yet. But I aim to fix that and to work on it. Dr. Perry would be pleased to know that the folks up there have long memories, and when I arrived, they looked at me kind of puzzled and said, except for the gray hair and the wrinkles, I think I remember you. Weren't you, you know, a decade and a half ago? And I said, yeah, it's me. I'm back. It's your worst dream, your worst nightmare. Not really. We're trying to figure out how to improve relations. The needs there are much more on the economic and governance side. These countries are in the middle. They have this resurgent Russia, which increasingly flexing its economic muscle. They have traditionally used the resources from this region for their to their betterment, and the folks in the region got little in exchange. The people in these countries want to change that. They would like to reap the benefits of the things that they have and to try to have a better better livelihood. It's very interesting that many of the Tajikistan, for example, in Kyrgyzstan, a significant part of this population actually works in Russia because that's where the jobs are. And not unlike the situation in this country where you have many, many folks from Latin America working here and remittances going home, that's exactly the situation in several of these countries in Central Asia. Other countries, Turkmenistan, I'll mention, which is a very interesting place. I'd never been there before. I'd commend it if you want a different experience. Coming out from under a rule of a strong man that made the place into his own image and likeness, that is, his image was plastered on just about every building in town. They have Ashgabat, the capital, is unlike any other place on earth. It's has hundreds and hundreds of new buildings that are very interesting to look at. Even more interesting to look inside, and there's nobody there, but the buildings are wonderful. And how is this possible? It's possible because of a phenomenal amount of income from oil and gas. They have a new president now who unexpectedly took over when Azov passed away suddenly at the end of last year. And I can see a dynamic tension there as he tries to decide what to do. He grew up in the Soviet era, and so he's got a lot of this background and culture. But just in the past couple of months, I can see things beginning to change. He told me that he recognizes he's beholden to Russia for about 80% of his financial income because that's where the oil and gas lines go. And the other 20% goes south into Tehran. And he's nervous about that because he doesn't like the behavior, as do the rest of the neighbors emanating from the Iranians. So what to do? What he wants to do is branch out east and west. He knows that markets in China are anxious for his oil and gas. So how to get it there? Well, it's going to have to go through Kazakhstan, maybe Afghanistan, lots of possibilities. They're interested. Going west, he told me he wants to put a pipeline through to Azerbaijan. But he said, we're running into an obstacle. I said, what's that? He said, well, you know, we have this undersea pipeline. I want to go across the Caspian, but the neighbors are objecting to it. Now, who would that be? Well, the Russians and the Iranians. And on what grounds? It's an environmental hazard, say they. So take that for what it's worth. But the point is that he's anxious. He recognizes where he is, and he wants to change. Now, the rest of the country doesn't look like Ashgabat. It's pretty pretty downtrodden and not unlike what it was probably 30, 40 years ago. So each country has a different story. The common themes I see are an interest in being independent. They don't want to be under somebody's thumb. They want to be able to have relations with people as they choose. They want to, the majority of the leaders, I think, want to have things better off for their people, and they're trying to figure out how to do it. And the extent to which we might be able to spare some expertise and help and encouragement and to have some reasonable security relationships. We are fortunate to have an air base at Manas, which allows us to get heavy transports into Afghanistan with supplies for our troops and to evacuate our wounded. And that's been very beneficial. We are not really interested in creating a lot of bases, only those relationships that are beneficial to both countries. But I think there's an awful lot of potential in Central Asia. You would like it.
We've come to the time for our last question, and I have to reveal to you that I think we need to have a brief lesson in jointness, because many people have asked, what is a Navy person doing in a job like this? So I'll give you the chance to have the last word.
Well, I think it has little to do with the color of the uniform, and I would think probably more to do with the gray hair and the years of experience and trying to bring my knowledge, background, and maybe the fact that I've seen some of these challenges before to bear on some very significant issues in the Middle East. I am challenged, humbled, and grateful to be given the opportunity to try to work these issues in the Middle East, because we have no more serious challenges today than these countries. I'm encouraged by the enthusiasm, the morale of our youngsters, by the knowledge and experience of those in leadership positions in governments, ours and others, by the enthusiasm of those in these countries, like Iraq, like Afghanistan, like Lebanon, who have endured decades of challenges and yet are willing to stand up, knowing that they could be killed in a heartbeat by the zealots that want them to remain beneath the surface and to have chaos continue. To have these people as examples is what encourages me to keep stroking and to keep moving. So it's an honor to serve you and to try to work to get to the stability and security that we all, I think, really want to have, and frankly, what the vast majority of people in each of these countries want as well. So it's been a pleasure to be with you. Thanks very much.
Thanks to Admiral William Fallon, Commander of the U.S. Central Command, for joining us tonight. We are grateful for his long and distinguished service to our country. Good evening.